Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Bethay, and you know if you join us on a regular basis, the slogan for this show, if there's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Corporative LLC captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change LLC serves as an economic blueprint for self-reliance for renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American-owned renewable energy companies to address the effects of high energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, to utilize African-American-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for renewable energy projects to bring down the under and underemployment of young African-American men and women locally and nationally, also to educate the African-American community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education through Black programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. You also know the show is brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLF HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative, and you're listening to this initiative over the platform of Blog Talk Radio. We can be heard on iTunes. We are streaming Facebook, Twitter, and Link. Also, ladies and gentlemen, this show is brought to you every week by the National Association of Blacks and Solar, which I am still the current setting president for the National Association of Blacks and Solar. And you can get more information on that organization by logging on to blacksinsolar.org, blacksinsolar.org. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very, very interesting show for you today. We don't have what we would say a live scheduled guest, but we're going to be rebroadcasting a podcast, which is done by Mr. John Farrell. He's with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. They are a nonprofit 501c3 organization building local power to fight corporate control. Local Energy Rules for the podcast homepage, a project of the Energy Democracy Initiative and an Institute for Local Self-Reliance Rules, bi-weekly podcast produced by the Energy Democracy Director, Mr. John Farrell, and a researcher, Mrs. Maria McCoy, along with audio engineer Drew Birchall, covers arts by McCoy. We share a series of common communities taking a concentrated power and transforming the energy systems. Our audience is researchers, grassroots organizers, and grassroots policy monks who want vivid examples of how local renewable energy can empower. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I felt this was a very outstanding piece that they did, and I'm going to play it to you in its entirety, but I'm going to set the stage first. The title of this particular podcast is called Utilities Gamble with Household Money, and this is their episode 187 on local energy rules. Now, as we've indicated that we're going to jump right into this, for the episode, the local energy rule podcast hosts John Burrell, who is joined by Tony Bartenham, projects writer for the Charleston Post and Carrier. They discuss how utilities have wrangled and lost billions of customers' dollars while consumers are on the hook for utilities that take financial risks, and how the unhappy customers can counter utility upgrades. Listen to the full episode and explore more resources below, which we will look at that. But before we do that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a look at the fact sheet, which has been put out by your White House, the Biden administration. Fact sheet, Biden-Harris administration releases updated fact sheet highlighting bipartisan infrastructure investment in all 50 states, D.C., and territories. Now, this particular piece is put out by the White House Council on Environmental Quality. And what I want to bring to your attention is that as the Biden administration, 18 months ago, the Harris administration, they hit the ground running to take advantage of a once-in-a-generation opportunity to rebuild the nation's infrastructure. The Infrastructure Week was a punchline under predecessor President Biden is delivering on infrastructure for the decade that is producing real results, connecting communities, creating good-paying jobs, and boosting the American manufacturing. The question is, as a black man in America of African-American descent, for who? Now, I'll tell you why I raised this question and why it's important for you to understand why we want to focus in on South Carolina, because first, that is my home state. I'm a native of South Carolina. I grew up in the PD area in a small rural town called Dillon, South Carolina. So I'm not speaking about something I don't know anything about. I'm speaking about where something I know about, how the state is divided based on the lowlands, or what we call the PD area, a low country, and the central of the state and upper state, which controls the resources of the state, and how monies never reach the PD region. With matter of fact, we have an economic impact study here in my office, which I'm going to share a little bit on four counties around the project I-73 and what it was supposed to do as it would impact four key counties, Marlboro County, Dillon County, Marion County, and Ory County, where Myrtle Beach is physically located. Myrtle Beach brings in $10 billion annually, but it's the last seashore resort that is not connected by a major interstate highway. After the U.S. Congress and Senate has sent $89 million to the state of South Carolina, and that money was supposed to be used to pay for property owners for right-of-ways and for economic impact studies. You will find out, which I will share later on in our show, none of this was done. And then it comes right back and it impacts on the Justice 40 initiative, which was the first executive order that President Biden signed, 14008, which says that 40% of the benefit from this Inflation Reduction Act, $357 billion. Spelled out how that money has gone out in the Investing in America agenda. Now, as part of President Biden's American agenda, administration has already announced over $220 billion in bipartisan infrastructures, lawful funding, including over 32,000 specific projects and awards across over 4,500 counties in all 50 states and territories. Today, the White House releases updated state-by-state fact sheets highlighting how across the country the Biden administration is rebuilding our roads, bridges, replacing lead pipes, providing clean water, cleaning up the legacy pollution, expanding access to affordable broad, high-speed broadband and internet, and ushering in a new era in clean energy. Now, you're going to find, ladies and gentlemen, that the red states receive more of this infrastructure investment than the blue states. You're going to also find, ladies and gentlemen, that in listening to President Biden's speech on last Friday, which was the 7th of July, when he was in West Columbia, South Carolina, when he spoke about all of the state legislatures who are federal representatives who voted against the Inflation Reduction Act. But yet they're receiving $11 billion. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, just I'm going to highlight South Carolina in this particular article because we're going to go into the podcast about what happened about energy in South Carolina as relates to the big ripoff, that we'll call it that. The Biden-Harris administration has hit the ground running, as we've indicated, and it is already delivering results for people of South Carolina. To date, $2.6 billion in bipartisan infrastructure funding has been announced and is headed to South Carolina. Over 160 specific projects identified for funding since the bipartisan infrastructure law was passed. Approximately $2.2 billion has been announced for transportation to invest in roads, bridges, and public transit, ports, and airports. And roughly $203 million has been announced for clean water. And as of today, more, roughly 335,000 households across the state are receiving affordable high-speed internet due to bipartisan infrastructure law. I question that because this money ain't out there yet, according to my folks who live in my home state, personal relatives. Many more projects will be added to the coming months and funding opportunities become grant awards as the formula of funding. Let me make sure we stay on point, ladies and gentlemen, this morning. I've got some issues with this my computer screen, so I'm trying to make sure we're on top of it. All right. With that being said, many more projects will be added in the coming months and funding opportunities become awards and adds formula funds become specific projects by reaching communities all across South Carolina, including rural communities and historically underserved populations. The law makes critical investments that will improve lives in South Carolina and the position the state for success. Roads and bridges, South Carolina, there is 745 bridges, over 3,786 miles of highway in poor conditions. Bipartisan infrastructure law will rebuild our roads and include single largest, most dedicated bridge investments in construction in the interstate highway system. Funding South Carolina is expected to receive $4.9 billion over the next 5 years in funding. To this date, they've already received $1.9 billion has been announced for South Carolina roads. $1.8 billion has been for highway form of funding, $118 million in dedicated formula funding for bridges, $12.8 million through the RAISE program for 22-23, Internet high-speed broadband, $100 million. Water, when we begin to look at that, to this date, the state of South Carolina has received $204 million has been announced for South Carolina for 22 and 23. Public transit, they would receive $373 million over 5 years. Announced funding to the date, you're talking about 71.3 million transits have already arrived. Clean buses, we're talking about announced funding to this date, 58.5 million through the Environmental Protection Agency. Electric charging, bipartisan infrastructure, we're talking about South Carolina has received 25.3 million with 22-23. Clean energy and power outages, you're talking about through outages in the economy, $700 billion annually. The state of South Carolina will receive $3.5 billion in weatherization, energy efficiency for homes, lower costs for those implications. Announcements and funding date, approximately 66.1 million has been allocated for South Carolina energy efficiency in for 22-23. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this information at positivechangepc.com. We're talking about 42.6 million for weatherization, 6.8 million through the state energy program, 6.1 million through the state energy efficiency conservation block grant program, 10.5 million to prevent outages to make power grid more self-reliant for additional grid funding will be made available in coming months. These are all, the information is already all here, ladies and gentlemen, and they spotlight a number of projects that are already, now this is under Investing in America's Agenda, and it's there for all 50 states, ladies and gentlemen. This is very, very important. That is why I wanted to make sure that I set this up. And then we're going to look at some of the other issues around that. But before we do that, we want to jump right on into our lead-in conversation. Lead-in topic, not conversation, is utilities gamble with household money. And you'll be listening to Mr. John Farrell as he interviews the gentleman from the Charleston Daily Post. You'll be the writer, Mr. Tony Bartolin, projects writer for the Charleston Post and Carrier. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen, for that oversight and pronunciation. And without further ado,
failure isn't necessarily a bad thing. We, you know, it's a very human thing for us to fail. And failure can be a gift when we learn from them. And in South Carolina, we learned a few lessons. We learned that best not to have utilities run amok and charge their ratepayers for projects with unproven design and lie about it in the process. And it helps to have regulators who are paying attention. Now, big question is, when you learn a lesson, do you fall back? Do you unlearn that lesson? And that's kind of where we're at now, I think.
The state of Colorado recently passed legislation to prevent electric utilities from using their customers' money to lobby on behalf of the private monopoly corporation. And I'd like to believe that some of the lawmakers involved have been inspired to explore this issue by Tony Bartle. Project writer for the Charleston Post and Courier in South Carolina, Tony wrote a landmark piece called Power Failure, that indicted electric utilities in several states for lighting, as he called it, a bonfire of risky spending, using money from captive customers on several high-profile project failures. I had the pleasure of speaking with Tony in May 2023 to learn about what motivated him to pursue this deeply researched piece and whether it still has relevance today. Farrell, director of the Energy Democracy Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and this is Local Energy Rules, a podcast about monopoly power, energy democracy, and how communities can take charge to transform the energy system. So, Tony, welcome to Local Energy Rules.
Yeah, John, it's great to be with you today. Thank you for your appreciation of puns, too.
You're welcome. You know, we had a good run, too, with podcast titles being puns, because one of my early employees that helped me develop the podcast was also a big fan. It's less popular lately as we've gotten a communications director who seems to think that not everything has to be a pun, but we've had a good run of it, at least at the best. I would love to just start off by asking you sort of a couple background questions really about how you ended up writing this piece. I think maybe specifically what sparked your interest in this topic back in 2017, but maybe also stepping back and asking you kind of what in your life, your training, your background led you to a path of reporting on utility issues in general.
Yeah, sure thing, John. So I'm a project reporter here in Charleston, South Carolina, but you can probably tell from my voice that I'm not from the South. I'm actually from Minneapolis originally. And I went to college in Chicago, and I had an economics class there really early in the morning, which unfortunately resulted in a kind of a poor grade. However, there was an issue that I carried with me for many years, and that was this idea of economic externalities. And in layman's term, it's essentially what a company produces that's extra to that production, and that extra is usually a cost passed on to other people at their expense. Air pollution is a classic example of an economic externality. And embedded in those economic externalities are usually the seeds of some injustice. And so if you kind of look at the world through that lens, you start identifying social and economic injustices that make fantastic stories. So that's what I look for.
Yeah, and so what was catching your eye then as you were working? That the piece that you did was extraordinary. It was definitely a kind of long-form reporting, a lot of detail about utilities in multiple different states. What put you or your editor onto this issue as one that you needed to cover back in 2017?
Yeah, the origin of that story really was one of South Carolina's biggest scandals. And you have to go back a little bit. There was a consortium of utilities that launched a project to build a nuclear reactor in the central part of our state. And they had high hopes for that. And they, even before they built that, they began to change, through their lobbying apparatus, began to change kind of the rule book about how plants are financed, these nuclear plants are financed. And long story short, that nuclear project was so poorly designed and built and engineered and built that it never was built. So we spent $9 billion building a couple of reactors that just went belly up. And it became so obvious, despite the sunny statements from the utility executives, it became such an obvious failure that they cut it midway, and it essentially was this giant failure. And everybody in the state was asking themselves, how did this happen? And so we dug really deep, and that was the origin of power failure.
And if I remember correctly, the cost was not negligible. So not just $9 billion being a huge amount of money to spend on a power plant that would never produce electricity, but it was going to have a significant increase in the amount that the average customer would pay on a monthly basis.
And it was going to be a significant increase that even began long before it produced power. And it was something that would last for decades. So it was this huge, huge impact on every single ratepayer in the state.
You used this really pointed phrase in the article, quote, a bonfire of risky spending. Could you talk a little bit about what were the policies that allowed these private utility companies to spend so much money on what ended up being a spectacular failure?
So in 2007, the South Carolina legislature passed something called the Base Load Review Act. And one of the most memorable things about that act is that it begins with the statement, an act to protect South Carolina ratepayers, which is, it turns out, kind of like saying clean coal. But essentially that law was part of a larger trend where utilities essentially could pass the costs of construction to their ratepayers as they designed, engineered, and built these giant projects. What that does is that it essentially passes risk to the ratepayers. And you know what happens when, you know, you have a chance to spend other people's money? That opens the door toward risky spending. And what we found is that this was happening not only in South Carolina, it was happening across the Southeast and Midwest. This sort of rewriting of the rule book essentially launched $40 billion in new power plants and upgrades in a 10-year period.
And just to be clear for folks, you know, the typical way that utilities pay for power plants, absent this kind of rule, is that they assume all of the financing risk and construction risk, and they are allowed to come and recoup those costs once the power plant is done and it's operating, and then they go to regulators and they say, okay, we built this $9 billion nuclear plant, it's now operating and producing electricity, we think that the expense of it was prudent, please let us collect that money from ratepayers. But in this case, that typical process was short-circuited and they were allowed to spend the money ahead of time, which, as it turns out, was a very bad idea.
That's right, John. So it's kind of easy to understand if you look at it in terms of a grocery store. You know, a grocery company builds a store with the idea that they thought really hard about this decision, that they think this is going to make money. It's a good decision. So they assume all the risk and pay for the construction of that grocery store. They do not pass that cost on to the customers until that grocery store begins selling the groceries. But in South Carolina and other states, we were essentially creating these grocery stores that charge customers for the construction of the grocery stores, not the groceries themselves.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we discuss whether utility regulators were asleep at the switch, what lessons Tony has learned from writing Power Failure, and who still needs to read that article. You're listening to a Local Energy Rules podcast with Tony Bartle, projects writer for the Charleston Post and Courier in South Carolina. Hey, thanks for listening to Local Energy Rules. If you've made it this far, you're obviously a fan, and we could use your help for just 2 minutes. As you probably noticed, we don't have any corporate sponsors or ads for any of our podcasts. The reason is that our mission at ILSR is to reinvigorate democracy by decentralizing economic power. Instead, we rely on you, our listeners. Your donations not only underwrite this podcast, but also help us produce all of the research and resources that we make available on our website and all of the technical assistance we provide to grassroots organizations. Every year, ILSR's small staff helps hundreds of communities challenge monopoly power directly and rebuild their local economies. So please take a minute and go to ilsr.org and click on the donate button. And if making a donation isn't something you can do, please consider helping us in other ways. You can help other folks find this podcast by telling them about it or by giving it a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. The more ratings from listeners like you, the more folks can find this podcast and ILSR's other podcasts, Community Broadband Bits, and Building Local Power. Thanks again for listening. Now, back to the program.
In theory, the way that this system is supposed to work is that we have these private companies that are our electric utilities, and they're given a monopoly over a particular area. So if you live in Charleston, if you live in Minneapolis, and you want to get electricity, there's only one company you're allowed to buy it from. And there's supposed to be these state regulatory bodies, public service commissions, public utility commissions, they go by a few different names, most of them very similar, that are supposed to be overseeing the work of these utilities and making sure that the things that they're doing are appropriate and reasonable. Are the regulators just asleep here? Why did that system of state oversight work in this case? How did it fall apart?
Yeah, you're exactly right, John. Utilities are legal monopolies. Most monopolies are illegal, but utilities have this legal monopoly status that works as long as the regulators are watching what they're doing. It's the regulators who assess the prudence of a particular power plant project or an attempt by a utility to ask for a rate increase. In South Carolina, the utility regulators were asleep at the wheel, and they were not only asleep at the wheel, they were misled as well. So in their defense, the utility executives in South Carolina, as they were building this nuclear plant, essentially lied to them and told them that everything was going pretty well when they knew very well that it was a dumpster fire.
Out of curiosity, did you end up in
interviewing any of the regulators for this piece to kind of get some of that perspective, or is most of the work documenting the enormous cost of the choices that the utilities have made?
Yeah, I didn't personally interview the regulators. Another reporter did. I did interview some of the executives who were involved in the project. And, you know, when you talk to these executives, it's kind of a, it's an interesting experience because you're sitting there, and I think some of them really believed that what they were doing was going to work. It kind of gets to the heart of, you can believe in a sunny scenario to the point where you don't really realize you're lying to people. And so I don't know. That would probably be kind of the best defense that they could offer for what they did. They certainly had plenty of data to know that their project was not being done well, and regulators needed to be told that to be able to make their decisions.
I think I recall that there have been some consequences for some of these decisions where in some places either the legislature or the regulators have required shareholders to pick up some of the cost overruns or the costs for things that were built. Were there ever consequences that you recall for any of the utility executives or even for the utility regulators who were not paying very close attention?
So that's a very interesting question, because in South Carolina, there were significant ramifications. The utility executives for SCANA, which was one of the utilities involved in the nuclear project, several of them pleaded guilty to criminal charges and ended up doing some jail time. The original act upon which that nuclear project was based, the Baseload Review Act, was repealed in 2018. Another utility executive lost his job. And overall, there was this fury among the electorate to do something. So hopefully, and at the same time, the regulators, too, were replaced. Several of the regulators were replaced with a more active group. Let's just say that.
I know you are a South Carolina-based reporter, so you might not know the answer to this, but I'm curious if you saw similar consequences in some of the other places. I know you talked about a plant in Mississippi as part of the piece. You mentioned the Midwest. Indiana might have been one of the other states, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think the most interesting example was next door in Georgia. So as we were building these nuclear reactors, Georgia Power, Southern Company, a consortium of utilities in Georgia were building an identical twin. And the regulators in Georgia actually were pretty much on the ball and making lots of warnings about what was happening. But the difference in Georgia is that the utilities had such a bigger rate base. They had many more customers that they could spread the costs around, that they just kept on going at it. And their reactor that they've been working on for more than a decade finally started generating some electricity just the other day, after $35 billion spent, and still not done. So no, there were very few ramifications in Georgia other than the ratepayers are stuck with some amount in the bills for foreseeable future. And in some of the other states, too, there was another project in Mississippi that we looked at. It was a coal gasification plant, again, a Southern Company project that also went absolutely nowhere. And again, hundreds of millions of dollars up in smoke.
I'm curious if there was any lessons that you learned in doing the reporting on that piece. Did your approach to writing about things that happen in the energy sector, about electric utilities, changed after publishing that piece or from based on the research that you did for it?
I think failure isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's a very human thing for us to fail. And failure can be a gift when we learn from them. And in South Carolina, we learned a few lessons. We learned that, it's probably best not to have utilities run amok and charge their ratepayers for projects with unproven design and lie about it in the process. And it helps to have regulators who are paying attention. Now, the big question is, when you learn a lesson, do you fall back? Do you unlearn that lesson? And that's kind of where we're at now, I think.
Are you saying that you're at this moment of where there's a risk of unlearning that lesson, or there are actual examples of things happening right now that seem to be indicating that people haven't learned that lesson?
I would say that we're at the risk of unlearning that lesson. And I say that because just the intense focus on what was happening, created all this scrutiny, and I think people behave a little better when they're watched. And so there was that spotlight. That spotlight has moved on to other things. That always makes me pay attention. Perhaps we need to take another look.
Feels like a good opportunity for me to talk to you about the way that some states are still having a lot of scrutiny. So in Colorado recently, and I think there's also a bill now up in Connecticut, there have been efforts to look at this issue around utility accountability. So in Colorado, the process started with there were at least one or maybe more fairly substantial rate increases being proposed by the investor-owned utilities, right, the private monopolies. And the legislature started holding hearings kind of asking about, like, why is this happening? This is multiple big rate increases over multiple years. And one of the things that the legislators identified as the problem was the power of these utilities to influence those who are supposed to be watching them. The bill in Colorado, for example, will prohibit utilities from charging customers for their lobbying of legislators to get them to pass policies favorable to their business, from paying for dues to trade associations, such as the Edison Electric Institute, which is often lobbying on behalf of utilities, either at the state or maybe more significantly at the federal level. The bill may even result in limiting the amount utilities can bill to customers or the time their lawyers spend in front of the Public Service Commission or the Public Utilities Commission asking for a rate increase, and instead say that that has to be billed to the shareholders of the corporation. So I guess I'm kind of curious if you feel like, in given what we've seen in South Carolina and these other states, these utilities run amok, do you feel like the efforts that they're making in Colorado and then the bill in Connecticut is very similar and addresses some of the similar things, that those might be actually helping to address some of the underlying behavior that led to, as you called it, the bonfire of risky spending?
I think the amount of campaign money and lobbying that is going into state legislatures is distorting policy. And I think there's ample evidence to show that even that these regulators have been influenced by lobbyists and campaign money. You know, in Georgia, the electric industry lobbyists plied commissioners with, you know, expensive meals and fancy hotel stays. And, you know, all of that has a corrosive effect on policy. So I think what's happening in Colorado is an interesting, you know, what I think the devil's in the detail. We'll see what happens. Does that sort of take some of the influence away from utilities? I hope so. In South Carolina, where there was an attempt about 3 years ago, I think, to prohibit members of the legislature from receiving campaign contributions from utilities, and that bill went up in flames very fast.
I'm kind of not surprised there's been some good reporting on energy policy stuff in Virginia, and that I've been compiling in that report that I've been working on, and it's just striking how many tens of thousands of dollars over various election cycles the utility companies are putting into contributions to legislators. I can understand that it would be very hard for them to want to turn that down.
Yeah, I think, you know, several years ago when we did the power failure project, we calculated that $1.4 billion was spent on federal lobbying by power companies and their allies. They gave $112 million to federal candidates, millions more into statewide races. It's a huge amount of money that, you know, is distorting policy.
I think it's interesting because the Colorado bill is noteworthy for being one of the first in recent memory to even address this issue about utility political power. But the thing that's sort of disappointing to me is that, and I'm kind of curious what you think about this, my sense of it is that if I am a captive customer of the utility, so as we referenced earlier, if I'm a Charleston resident or a Minneapolis resident, I can't pick my utility company, which means that the usual means available to me as a U.S. consumer of some change where I spend my money, if I don't like the politics of the company that I'm buying from, is not available. So I just think about, I remember 10 years ago or something, there was a boycott of Bria Pasta because they were saying things that were, you know, not supportive of gay marriage, for example, or, you know, there are people in Florida are boycotting Disney because they were in opposition to the governor's Don't Say Gay law. And I guess I'm kind of curious, as someone who is obviously, as a reporter, as a journalist, as someone who's, I think, representing what the First Amendment is all about, how you feel about the idea that utilities have this power at all. My argument, honestly, has been, why should utilities be allowed to lobby, period? because they have this privilege of being monopoly companies, and that it seems to me that that free speech ought to go hand in hand with competition and choices for customers.
Great point, John. Yeah, I think one of the root causes, or one of the most pervasive feelings during our big nuclear fiasco, was this sense of powerlessness, this lack of power, this inability to even vote on what was happening to your power bill. So the regulators are, you know, that's our essentially our conduit to making changes. But I don't know if many people know who our regulators are and how to contact them, and whether that's even something that they should do. There's no real democratic connection to policy.
Are there other things that you had hoped that I would ask you about that I haven't yet, or other pieces about the article, or your other things that you've been working on that are related that you want to chat about?
I've been working on some non-utility things for a while now. Working on a lot of climate change stories, where I look at stories that other people are neglecting, and I try to identify issues that are essentially hidden in plain sight. And one of the stories I've been working on is about how dust from the Sahara flows over the Atlantic and essentially turns on and turns off our hurricanes, and climate change is going to do something to that mechanism. You try to look for the invisible.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Is that a piece that will be done soon, or something that's kind of longer term?
It's a piece that'll be published in late June, June 25th. And for that project, we were fortunate enough to get a grant to go to Western Africa and, you know, put our feet on the sand and dust that is actually transported across the ocean. And then really the thing that kind of got me most excited was talking to the researchers who are doing work there, who are so often neglected because science has this forever tilt toward Europe and the United States. Their voices tend to be drowned out.
Well, let me ask you one last question about power failure, this piece that you wrote so notably 6 years ago. If I had a $10,000 budget for communications, who do you think really needs to have that article in their hands? How could it continue to provide benefits for folks who are concerned about the ways that utilities wield their power, that they spend customer money? Who do you really wish would read that piece, given that I think, unfortunately, it's still very relevant in 2023, just as it was in 2017?
I think it's incredibly relevant today. So I would hope that anybody who pays a power bill would read it, because even though it's pretty long, it helps you understand why your bills are so high, some of the abuse that takes place. And, you know, if you kind of understand this financing mechanism, maybe you can make some better decisions. Maybe you can contact your lawmakers to contact those regulators and prevent another $9 billion fiasco.
Well, Tony Varley, thank you so much for joining me on Local Energy Rules. Thank you for your reporting work. That piece really inspired me, frankly, to spend more time looking at this issue of utility accountability, and I think many others who have also been doing work in that space. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention energy and policy, incredible amount of work across the country helping to document these kinds of issues from Virginia to the Southeast, Florida to Colorado, California. And I like to believe that they were similarly inspired by this work as well, as they've been growing their portfolio of looking at utility accountability. So thank you again for your work and for taking the time to talk with me today.
You bet, John. Thank you for digging into this. It's really important.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode.
Ladies and gentlemen, you were just listening to John Farrell and Mr. Tony Bartolin, who is a writer for the Charleston Post and Carrier, who covers climate and environmental issues for that paper in South Carolina. And I took issue with a number of things I heard as it relates to the regulators were simply not paying attention. Yes, that, ladies and gentlemen, the regulators were paying very, very close attention to what was going on. Here we have theft. We're going to call it what it is. And it impacts the African-American community even more. Now, I indicated to you that I was going to share with you economic impact study that was put out with your tax dollars on a project called I-73 as it relates to where we are and what we're doing at the present time in looking at the economic impact study that was published. And I just had that in my viewing space, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm still struggling trying to pull that particular document up for you. So I've got to close something going, so we're going to do just that quickly, and we're going to pull the documentation up as it relates to that South Carolina economic impact study that we were looking at. And the economic impact study of I-73 in South Carolina, the existence of I-73 will inject billions of dollars into the I-73 in South Carolina and provide tens of thousands of jobs in tourism, retail, service, and warehouse industries. After road completion, annual economic impacts estimated at $2 billion will sustain 22,347 jobs in South Carolina by 2032 and beyond. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as this study went on, I'm reading to you the conclusion of this study. The proposed interstate systems will inject billions of dollars into South Carolina and create jobs in the retail, service, warehouse, and tourism industry. After the completion of I-73, both existing businesses and potential new businesses can benefit from the interstate. For existing businesses on I-73 corridor, the interstate can improve travel efficiency and produce cost savings for up to $120.8 million by year 2030. The most immediate new businesses associated with the construction of I-73 are service businesses clustering around. These services business will serve both motorists on I-73 and local residents. They can generate economic impacts of $401.9 million and support 3,200 jobs per year in South Carolina, most of them being located in its I-73 can support distribution centers, western portion of the I-73 within the economic impact of $31.1 million and 286 jobs by year 2030. Now, Myrtle Beach portion of I-73, I-95, route taken most by visitors, route boasts tourism of 7.1% of the annual income of $1.8 billion in South Carolina and the creation of 18,856 jobs, most in on the beach area. The state and local governments in the region are expected to reap considerable financial benefit from the project when the projects are completed. It is estimated by 2030, South Carolina state government will receive $86.1 million in sales taxes and gasoline, corporate and individual income tax, the local governments on I-73 will receive annual benefits totaling $43.2 million by 2030 in the form of local sales tax, hospitality accommodations, and taxes. Now, this is the problem with this, ladies and gentlemen. When you stroll down and you look at these numbers, executive summary tells you that the United States Congress designated Interstate I-73 and 74 as corridor as a national significance connecting the Great Lakes regions of the Carolinas, coast of South Carolina, I-73 traveling with northern parts of the state through Dillon, Marion, Marlboro, and Oree counties. That's very key, ladies and gentlemen. Now, let me break it down for you. Those counties are the most impoverished three counties in the state next to the wealthiest county in the state, which is Oree County, where Myrtle Beach is physically located. Marlboro, Dillon, and Marion have population base under 35,000. Myrtle Beach has a population base of over 400,000. Total, that's 500,000 people impacted. But let's look at the economics and impact of this. Now, they talk about the strategic economic impact of I-73 can potentially attract businesses such as distribution centers in rural parts of I-73. The proposed I-73 would likely accelerate the development of proposals in South Carolina Atlantic International Logistics Center, Western Marion County, 3,000 square acre site that will be located in on the I-95, less than 7 miles, which will fully build the SIAC, which will contain 15 million square feet of industrial, commercial, manufacturing space and directly create 15,000 jobs in Northeast South Carolina. That is the economic impacts that this highway is supposed to bring. Problem is, ladies and gentlemen, they ain't broke ground to build a highway. Now, this is economic impact studies and summaries, but I'm looking at the three counties, and as it relates to, it talks about the GNP and that these counties have not grown since 1969, ladies and gentlemen, as you begin to look at the statistical data, the population and growth on the corridor. And as I indicated, 2000 census, Dillon County 30,722. Marion County, 35,000. So one county did hit that outside of Oree County, 466. Marlboro County, 28,818. But you have 12,000 residents in Oree County. No. 263,000. 263,000. I stand corrected, which brings the total of 4,561,212 in that four county population base region for those four counties. And it talks about when the last economic growth in the quarter, showing that there's been no growth in Dillon County since 1970 through 2009. Same for Marion, same for Marlboro, but Oree County has grown because it brings in today, ladies and gentlemen, close to $10 billion annually. And these numbers have changed since to the last major census. So all that has to be taken in consideration. This data and information was published and put out, and the I will provide the sources for that information, because I think it's very, very important that we document what we are doing here, ladies and gentlemen. We are at the closing end of our show, ladies and gentlemen. We have about 4 more minutes to this show. But I hope that we connected the dots and we brought information to you about South Carolina. The question becomes, how is this being addressed when you can see all of these billions of dollars being poured in? Albemarle Corporation is pouring in $1.3 billion in Chester. The question is, how does the African-American business and farmer in those counties, how are they going to be impacted? How are these jobs going to, who's going to show accountability on, as it relates to hiring practices in these red, hard red districts? We have in Dalton, Georgia, you have a North Korean corporation investing, Qcell investing $2.3 billion to build the largest solar manufacturing facility in the North American hemisphere. But when you call and ask for data surrounding employment of African Americans, which yours truly has done this in the past, no one wants to speak to you. So it's very interesting to me how these billions of dollars are going into these rural communities, whether they be in red or blue states, that don't have a lot of African-American population living directly around these plants because they're in these rural counties. Who's going to be mining those numbers since race can no longer be considered in education, also in employment, ladies and gentlemen? We got work to do. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, this show is brought to you every week by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC. And you know what the slogan for this show is: if there's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, captures that power for your financial to address the high energy costs. And it serves as an economic blueprint for self-reliance for renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American-owned renewable energy companies to address the effects of high energy costs at our historically black colleges and universities, to utilize African-American-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for renewable energy projects to bring down the unemployment numbers of African and African-American men and young men and women locally and nationally and throughout the diaspora. It also educates the African and African-American communities locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education through Black Talk Radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you an example of what is going on. Even with the Justice 40 initiative that's only been adopted in 4 states and South Carolina being one of those states, what will be the economic impacts to the African-American community? How does this benefit South Carolina State, Claflin, Benedict, Area Trade, and the other HBCUs within the state? What will it do for workforce development training? All these are questions that we can't get answered today, but we want you to know, ladies and gentlemen, we want to always say We try to bring you information, news that you can definitely use. We think we did that today. There is one other subject matter called the Solar for All. Deliver billions of dollars of benefits to disadvantaged communities. You're going to want to check that out on our website at Positive Change and PC. PositiveChangePC.com. That's info at PositiveChangePC.com. And as we said, until next week, ladies and gentlemen, we don't want you to meet us back here. We want you to beat us back here. And as we always say, we're colored. We close every week, ladies and gentlemen. We always say, go in peace. Until next week, we don't want you, as we said, to meet us back here, but to beat us back here as we close another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with this economic impact on Black America. We say, go in peace.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan.
Singing. Why don't you
sing it?